Hello and welcome to another video blog edition of the Drazen Report. Thanks so much for watching. You may catch this on the Duran YouTube channel or on my website. Doesn't matter. Thanks for watching. For those who can't seem to find me still, by some miracle you haven't found me yet, my website address is in the opening sequence to this video. So it's spelled out in the opening sequence to this video. So please come to the site, check it out, look through the archives, sign up for my mailing list if you don't mind. It's at the sign up option is at the bottom of each post on the website. Thanks for stopping by. Now I have a multi-part episode for you today. The first thing I would like to cover is some of the financial aspects of the new Cold War against Russia. We have seen mysterious movements in the ruble that are really very easily explained. So right now the ruble is in a 60 handle holding pattern. That is to say the USD RUB currency pair has been roughly stuck between 62 and 69. And why does it move around that spectrum? Well, you can see that at the same time as the ruble moves sharply within that range, the USD EUR currency pair also moves sharply. Okay. And what that means is the euro falls against the dollar, or it falls in general, when the ruble strengthens. And why is that? Well, because every time that some big German gas company or some big Italian or Austrian gas company has its gas bill due, and now they have to pay in rubles, they have to put out, you know, a very, very strong short-term bid for rubles, whether it's with Gazprom Bank or whoever. And then the ruble strengthens because the demand is there and the price of the ruble goes up. And when that money is brought out of the, when that capital is brought out of Europe, of course, the euro as the currency of Europe falls. So there is now a very strong, very, very strong inverse relationship, direct inverse relationship between the ruble and the euro. And the Europeans are going to be hating life pretty soon for a lot of reasons, as I'm sure you've probably heard on my blog and on the Duran, but not least because the fact is that they used to buy their gas with euros, and now they have to pay rubles for it. And what that's done since the implementation of the gas for ruble scheme, where they have to pay for their gas in rubles, that alone has brought the USD EUR currency pair from about 91 to now 96. That is to say that the euro has lost close to 5% of its value against the dollar just in recent weeks, simply because now they have to pay for their gas in rubles. And thus, euro demand is lower. And this is a lot of money. I mean, every few days, they spend something like a billion euros on, or the ruble equivalent, on Russian gas. So, you know, you're looking at 150 billion or something like that, maybe more each year, roughly. I don't know the exact figure, but somewhere around there. And basically, that used to be all euro demand. That used to be, euro demand for the euro to pay for Russian gas. And now that 150 billion or whatever has just been basically taken out of European finances and exchanged for the ruble. So clearly we see that the gas for ruble scheme has substantially weakened the euro by literally 5% alone, just that in the last few weeks. The euro is also suffering for other reasons. They have to pay. Now, of course, the European trade imbalances are growing. They have to pay a lot more for all of their imported raw materials. They're also now pumping up their military budgets, and a lot of those weapon systems are going to be imported from the USA. Almost all of the combat aircraft, essentially all of the combat aircraft and air defense systems, at a minimum, are going to be coming from the USA. So their trade imbalance structurally is growing, and the demand for their own currency now is going to be lower and is going to be reflected in the currency pairs, as always happens. So we know by now that the ruble is not going anywhere, and the only real question is it going to strengthen to the point where it gets a 50 handle instead of a 60 handle on the USD RUB currency pair? We'll see. Also want to say a little bit more about the silly people in the US government and elsewhere that keep saying, look, it's Russian capital controls that are keeping the euro afloat. It's Russian capital control. Look, European banks today, Cypriot banks, American banks, Canadian banks, they will not take money from Russia. If you're inside Russia, or even if you're just a Russian national even living abroad, you're radioactive now. Okay, and the traditional mechanism for the traditional path for rich people and oligarchs, you know, bringing their money out of Russia was through European banks, Cypriot banks, American banks. That has been shut off. Even they're going away above and beyond the sanctions. Even, you know, smaller Russian banks that have not been sanctioned, Europe, Cyprus, America still don't want that money. They don't want to touch it. They think it's, you know, it's radioactive. They're going above and beyond the sanctions and essentially implementing their own capital controls against Russia. Way more. So that's way more consequential than anything Russia's doing. Okay. Because Russia at most is saying, well, you can't bring more than $10,000 in physical cash out of the country. They might have raised that a little now, but at the start of the war it was $10,000. And, you know, they're searching people at airports and so forth. But it used to be people would bring millions and billions out into European banks, Cypriot banks, American banks. And now the Americans, the Europeans, they don't want that money. They don't want to touch it. So that is the capital control, right? Much more so than what Russia's doing. So, you know, when you hear these people say, well, Russia's artificially propping up the ruble with capital controls. No. America, Europe, and Cyprus are doing a lot more to artificially prop up the ruble with capital controls than Russia is. As strange as it may sound, but it's true. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is often wrong, and in this case, it is. So, it is wrong as well. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk about is the failures, repeated failures, constant failures. When failure is structural, it's not really failure. It's just part of the plan, I guess. But the failures of the U.S. intelligence complex. Now, I want to preface this by saying that I have here a bottle of Crimean wine that is Masandra brand. It's basically the flagship wine brand of Crimea. I believe it's state-owned, used to be Ukrainian state-owned, or perhaps the Autonomous Republic of Crimea state-owned winery, and considered the best winery in Crimea. And this is from 2013. So it's the last year that Crimea was part of Ukraine. It actually says product of Ukraine. Okay. And the next year, the vintage, you know, for 2014, of course, said a product of Russia, right? So this is really a almost like a time capsule or a memento. I don't know what you call it, but it's something very special. And I got it priced out. I got it priced out by some online, you know, wine expert, legit. And they told me, well, you know, it may be a good bottle of wine, but it's really not worth more than $20. I'm like, okay. Look, I could hold on to this for another however many years, probably sell it on eBay for hundreds of dollars, I'm guessing. Just or to some, you know, some collector who doesn't necessarily do wine, but just likes the fact that this is potentially the last bottle of wine, you know, of Ukrainian wine ever made in Crimea, right? But so the fact is that this wine expert, he's an expert in wine. He's not an expert in you know, politics or political memorabilia per se, right? And so I was thinking about the Ukraine war, and if you look at all of these smart people who are, you know, the intelligence, you know, experts that consult with CNN and Fox and whatever, and people like David Petraeus and all those people that are on TV as some kind of experts. And you remember when Russia was when Russia and Donetsk forces were first encircling Mariupol and going into Mariupol, and everyone was saying, no, they're not going to take Mariupol. They don't have the forces, right? Because they only, you know, that you for to do an urban assault against entrenched, dug-in enemy, you have to have a numerical superiority of 10 to 1. And they're only, you know, maybe 2 to 1 or even 1 to 1. And it's not going to work. And they're not going to take Mariupol, right? And of course, when Russia took Mariupol, then they forgot about what they, you know, had said earlier. And then they moved the goalposts and they said, well, Russia's not going to take something else, right? They forgot about Mariupol, wrote off Mariupol. But why were they saying that? Well, the fact is, they don't know Russia and they don't know what's going on over there. And they don't even know Ukraine. The fact is, yeah, if you were in Iraq, if you were the U.S. Army in Iraq, or if you were the U.S. Army in Afghanistan, yes, if you wanted to take, you know, Fallujah or Baghdad or whatever, or Mosul, yeah, you needed a 10-to-1 advantage in manpower, right? If you were going up against 3,000 dug-in ISIS, you needed 30,000 men to do that, 30,000 trained men to advance on that city, okay. But and that's sort of, you know, the conventional wisdom for urban assault operations. And but in this case, the Russian Donetsk forces were able to do that with 2 to 1 or maybe less. So what gives? Well, what gives is the fact is that first they use new tactics, they use new technologies, and on top of that, they had a favorable population there that simply was not helping the Ukrainians. They were not spotting for them. They weren't doing anything for them. That's why Russia was able to take that city miraculously, this very large city of in peacetime, 400 some thousand people, defended by over 8,000 very well-armed, very well-trained Ukrainian personnel, including most of the Azov. And they took it within a month. And, you know, the Azov are still holed up in that factory. But other than that, they've basically taken the city. They're bringing the electricity back. You know, they're trying to clean it up as best they can. And so everything that these American intelligence experts thought they knew, right? It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant because you're looking at Iraq, you know, or something. You don't realize what's going on here. What's going on here is the fact is that Russia and Donetsk are liberating their own people, and it's a completely different dynamic than, you know, going to occupy Fallujah where you're hated and you're not wanted. Okay, and on top of that, the people defending Fallujah were probably from Fallujah. The people, you know, whereas the Azov are mostly not from Mariupol. Okay, so it's totally different. And but you know, they don't know anything, and they're just talking based on heuristics and the conventional wisdom and all that. And here the intelligence is so-called intelligence. They're good for operational. You know, they can use satellite imagery and electronic signals intercepts to go sink a Russian ship. But as far as figuring out like what's really going on the ground with the people on the ground, they have no idea. Recently, a unnamed U.S. Department of Defense official sat down with a bunch of media people and gave an interview that was on record but unattributed. Right, it's just a senior official, and a bunch of U.S. media sources covered this. And one of the things that this person said was, anecdotally, we have reports that Russian soldiers are no longer taking orders from their command. They're tired, they're worn out, they don't want to fight anymore, and they're starting to disobey orders. And even officers, even Russian officers, are starting to disobey orders or to sabotage the orders and not carry them out. And this is anecdotal, based on anecdotal reports. Okay, what does anecdotal mean? Anecdotal is from the word anecdote. What does that mean in this case? That means Ukraine says, right? Ukrainian Twitter, Ukrainian Telegram, Ukrainian Facebook. It's the same junk that they've been feeding people for the last, you know, 2.5 months of this war. And why? Because they don't know, okay? They have at their disposal, at the disposal of the U.S. Department of Defense, they have the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is not quite as large as the CIA, not as large as the CIA, but it's still a very large agency. It's a sort of central intelligence bureau for the entire Department of Defense. It has thousands of civilian employees and thousands more detailed military personnel to it. And they hypothetically can also rely on borrowed intelligence from the CIA and from other agencies. And yet they have no clue what's going on there on the ground. Okay, they have to rely on Ukrainian Twitter, Ukrainian Facebook, and it's probably what they're feeding the president or whoever is awake at these meetings where the president attends. So why is this? Well, I'm guessing that they focus so heavily on the Arabic track that, and maybe even now the Chinese track, and they've really neglected the Russian track. And they, you know, it's the Cold Wars, it was a long time ago, and so they probably don't have really anybody credible there now that speaks or understands Russian or Ukrainian. And they're so, because they don't have anyone that does the language or can understand, even do signals intercepts, right? We're listening to radio transmissions and translating them like they used to do in the Cold War. They're probably not doing that. I mean, they're just relying, what it seems like is it's just they're relying on Ukrainian propaganda and Ukrainian Twitter. And, on the face of it, we know that an army that's advancing, I mean, even if you're taking losses, an army that's advancing typically has fairly high morale. And, you know, so what they're saying about, well, Russians, the officers are no longer following orders. Well, how is it that they're constantly taking territory, even if it's slow, right? So just on the face of it, it just seems a little weird. You have to really ask. Well, the problem is probably they have no one that's competent in the Russian or Ukrainian language or culture to actually follow what's going on there and intercept signals and translate intercepted communications and so forth like they used to do back in the day. And what else can you expect from them? They're going to rely on Ukrainian Twitter, Ukrainian Facebook. Now, moving on to some tactical developments, or you could say strategic developments, in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas. So basically, with the fall of Popasna, as I've covered recently in my last video, and I have to issue a correction. I told you that Popasna was not particularly heavily damaged based on the footage that I had seen. Well, the footage was fairly limited to a section of downtown that was relatively intact. But I've since seen a lot of other footage of, and that place is trashed. That town is trashed. It's as trashed as Mariupol or Volnovakha almost as trashed as anywhere in the Donbass that's seen heavy fighting. And so unfortunately, really that town is no longer livable. Will have to be reconstructed by Russia after the war. But anyway, after the fall of Popasnaya, the Russian and Donetsk forces are very quickly reconnoitering areas to the north of that. They seem to have advanced as much as potentially 7, 8, maybe 10 kilometers north, northeast of Popasnaya, which is, for this war, it's a very fast rate of advance. I mean, we're probably talking about infantry scouts so far, not the main forces, but they are very quickly advancing north from Popasnaya, which for them is a very good sign, because typically the advances in this theater of the war do not happen quickly. So we're talking about an operation to, as I covered in my last video, the part of the operation to encircle, cut off the Ukrainian forces that are occupying Severodonetsk and Lysychansk urban agglomeration in the north of the Lugansk province or Lugansk People's Republic, depending on which side you're on. You can call it however you like. From the north, we know that we have video evidence now that Russian or Donetsk scouts have in fact entered into western Severodonetsk and quite some distance, and are in fact have really entered the urban zone. Not in force. It's probably scouting, but the fact is they are seriously looking to encircle the Ukrainians in that area. Unfortunately for them, there was quite a bit of difficulty with the only way they can. The avenue from the south is clearly set out. They are advancing north of Popasna and towards now Artemovsk and some other directions. And from the south, the advance is doing very well. Now, from the north, what they have to do is they have to cross the Seversky Donets River and to link up with the forces coming from the south. And unfortunately, as tends to happen, the Ukrainians blew all the bridges, right, across the Seversky Donets River. So the Russians, as they had to do near Izum, same river, but quite a bit further to the west, as they had to do around Izum back at the end of March and the beginning of April, they had to build a pontoon bridge. And so a temporary bridge that's laid out by engineering units, typically, in modern times, it's basically sort of these semi-floating metal plates that interlock and connect, and then they stretch from shore to shore. And in this case, they have been trying to build a pontoon bridge. They've tried multiple times, and it's been destroyed by Ukrainian artillery each time. I think there were as many as five attempts. I think that's exaggerated. It seems like it was about three, but there was maybe even two. But there are two or three pontoon bridges under construction that were actually basically destroyed, and you can see them from aerial footage the Ukrainians put out. You can see them in the water just lying there. Also a very large amount of burnt out Russian hardware in the area, especially on the south bank of the river. There's roughly the better part of a battalion's worth of some tanks, mostly armored vehicles and armored infantry fighting vehicles that have been basically burnt out and left there. Didn't see any bodies on the aerial footage that came out, but a lot of hardware, and it looks really bad. But from the Russian perspective, they absolutely have to cross the river, and this is really the one spot where they have control of the north bank of the river, closer to Severodonetsk-Lysychansk. So they really had to go with a crossing here. And what's happening is the Ukrainian artillery has them pre-sighted and just keeps hammering away at this crossing. And if the fact that the artillery just keeps shooting at this area and hasn't been taken out yet, very, very likely the artillery is firing out of Lysychansk city to the east, some miles to the east. So very, very likely that the artillery's dug in, probably firing from inside of Lysychansk city. And they've probably given themselves away by now. So they'll probably be destroyed fairly soon if they haven't been already. But the fact is, that's probably why they have gotten away with being able to, operate to date, is because they were, Russia is always somewhat hesitant to launch airstrikes and artillery strikes at our urban areas in the Donbas that are obviously favorable to Russia and simply waiting to be liberated. But now it looks like there's no choice. So what's interesting is that the aerial views that the Ukrainians released, if you know what you're looking at, you can see most of the Russian vehicles that were knocked out there were actually amphibious infantry fighting vehicles that were mostly on the south bank. So what it looks to me like is that, and they were not new, it was not modern hardware. It looks like Russia knew they were going to take a lot of losses there, and they sent in a bunch of old stuff, and they basically sent it across the river, just drove it across the river amphibiously and to get to the South Bank to try to secure the South Bank, even as the pontoon bridges were being constructed. So as of now, it is believed that there are Russian, at least some Russian forces that have made it to the South Bank and that have secured themselves on the South Bank and are defending positions on the South Bank of the Seversky Donets River, that they have a beachhead on the south side of it. But we don't really know the defendability, defensibility, or, you know, how they're holding out or whatever. We just know that they're very likely there because directly or indirectly, the Ukrainian army, the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense has basically, over its communiques, has admitted that they have not yet managed to extract the Russians from the South Bank. So for that, among other reasons, it's believed that the Russians are in the South Bank. The problem is that they don't have a bridge there, so they can get more of these amphibious infantry fighting vehicles across the river. But the amount of supplies and extra ammo and so forth that those vehicles can take with them is fairly limited. So you really have to have a bridge that supply trucks can drive across. And so we'll see how they do. But the situation in general, it's reminiscent of the fighting around the pontoon bridge that was southwest of Izum that they were trying to build essentially for the entire second half of March, where they were under constant artillery bombardment trying to build a bridge and build a bridge. And they lost a colonel there who was supervising directly on the site the building of the bridge. Because Russian officers lead from the front. They don't hide in air-conditioned offices. They lead from the front, and they actually lost a colonel there. And but finally, they did build that bridge and established a massive beachhead, and, you know, the rest is history. Basically, they took very firm control of Izum and have a pretty large staging area now south and east of Izum for further operations in the Donbas. But in recent days, absolutely, the advance has slowed. They can't maintain the same tempo for too long. So clearly, the advance has slowed. But we'll see how this beachhead does west of Lysychansk. Because if they can secure themselves there, take out the Ukrainian artillery finally, and get an actual bridge that they can bring more forces and supplies across, then the fate of the Ukrainian forces holding out in the Severodonetsk-Lysychansk agglomeration in northern Lugansk is sealed. And that would be really the second big cauldron of the war after Mariupol. Obviously, Mariupol was the first. This would be the second. I would say it's very likely to happen, but I'm not going to give you a timeline. So I just want to make one final note about artillery and how it is really most of the personnel that have been killed or wounded on the Russian side, almost all have been from Ukrainian artillery fire, to include, for the most part, rocket artillery. That is to say, Grad rockets and higher caliber Smerch and Orgon rockets as well, as well as mortars. There's been really, really very, 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 very few Russians and Donetsk and Lugansk forces that have been killed or had their tanks blown out from under them with these javelins or enlaws or, you know, wonder weapons that have come from the NATO countries. Very, very, very few. There's very, very few cases that are documented where, you know, Russian armor was destroyed with these types of weapons. I mean, there's a few videos out there, but relative to the thousands and thousands of tube launched anti-tank weapons that have been provided to the Ukraine by the U.S. and its allies, very, very few. The very few have been successfully used. It's mostly still artillery, and it's mostly still Soviet era artillery, and mostly Grad rockets and mortars. So the problem with Grad rockets is they are not too smart. The range is fairly limited. Unlike tube launched artillery shells, Grods cannot really, it's, they can't, my understanding is they can't be, they don't have a ground proximity fuse. So basically they hit the ground, they blow up. For heavy armor, it's much more effective to use tube launched, you know, cannon launched artillery shells that have ground proximity fuses that can blow up in, you know, some distance off the ground to disable heavy main battle tanks. Because the fact is that even heavy tanks have very, very, very minimal armor at the top of their turrets. And so that's a very, very weak point. And so right now, the NATO countries are trying to get as much cannon, as many cannons as possible into the Ukraine, because they realize that these Grad MLRS systems are, you know, not hugely. I mean, they're very effective against personnel. They're not necessarily hugely effective in all cases against the heavy armor. So they're trying to do that. So far, they have not been successful. To my knowledge, so far, of all the videos that I've seen, all the photo documentation, there has not yet been one self-propelled cannon from the Western countries that has actually been fielded in by the Ukrainians in the Donbas. It looks like there may have been a video of, it's not clear exactly where it is, but there's a video going around where there's a towed American towed 155 millimeter howitzer potentially in the Donbas, but it's just one, and no self-propelled cannons that we've seen so far. So again, all of this talk about getting heavy weapons to the Ukrainians so far is just talk, but it's potentially serious because these things are generally potentially more damaging than what the Ukrainians are using right now. They have longer range than really anything in the Russian or the Ukrainian arsenal. Typically, Western artillery systems, cannons have longer barrels, which guarantees a longer range. So the maximum effective range typically of Grad rockets as well as Russian artillery is somewhere around 30, 35 kilometers, something like that. American and British and other Western cannon can shoot to 50 kilometers. So this is, if this stuff gets into the Donbas and is actually fielded and used, it could potentially be very, very troublesome to Russia. But as of now, they really have not gotten it to the Donbas yet. So they have, obviously, I've written about on my blog, they have transportation problems. Russia is wrecking the Ukrainian rail system in the West. It's not completely destroyed yet, but it's certainly being brought to chaos. There's also a question of, you know, do they have enough competent crews on the Ukrainian side to really operate this stuff? And even if they do train the crews, you know, you do need good commanders. You need some kind of integration of these systems into existing units, and that doesn't happen overnight. So we'll see if Russia can advance far enough and basically have at least a tentative victory in the Donbas before these Western weapon systems are fielded. But so far, as of yet, they have not been fielded. I'm talking about the big, heavy stuff, not the javelins and all that. The javelins, total failure. Now they're going for the heavy stuff. We'll see how that works. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you in a following edition. Thank you.